Opposition to neoliberal hegemony is fine, normal stuff. But going into an alliance with fascists is bad for a number of reasons. It's just stupid. It's bad strategy.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing fine. For some reason, I woke up at like 5:30 this morning. I could not get back to sleep.
How is your plug experience going?
Just same as everybody else's, I guess. Not really much happening around here. Just trying to keep up with my dissertation stuff and, taking it one day at a time.
How did you first get interested in radical politics?
I'd say probably just as a youngster when I was growing up, I had a lot of sort of punk influences and, got really into sort of alternative music scene. And I always felt like the civil rights movement was, perhaps one of my biggest influences, but should be extended to everybody and to economic justice as well. So yeah, just growing up, I just had a lot of feelings about being trapped in school and not wanting to be, a cog in a machine and all that kind of stuff. So I've always been a sort of a radical of sorts, although, I don't know what the term means and I don't really associate it with it.
That's understandable. I went to a small high school in a small town. I had a graduating class of about 600. What was your high school like?
My high school was actually pretty small. I think probably about 600. Yeah, I would say that. I actually ended up going to a religious high school, and we had chapel every day. So that was formative, for me as I just tried to navigate my own kind of arguments with the world and in terms of spirituality and life, So. I think going to a religious school was really hard for a lot of reasons because I'm not a religious person. But it was also rewarding because I got to get into arguments and learn a lot about different religions and how they work.
And what did you do first out of high school?
First out of high school, I went to college. Which is probably a mistake. I should have
Yeah.
probably taken a year off and traveled around or whatever. I had a pretty good first year in college at Trinity in Hartford. But the thing is that with the Iraq War and stuff, I was really against the Iraq War at the time, and I just saw it all unfolding in this, really crazy mutation of reality. It just felt like every morning you could predict what you would see on the news because it would be the worst thing you could imagine. And I just kind of had a rough time through all of that psychologically, went through a lot of mental health issues, and it took me a couple of years to get back on my feet. So it was kind of rough growing up there in the early 2000s, but I feel like me and my generation were a lot stronger emotionally and more stable now. We're able to endure more psychologically because we went through all of that. I guess that's the silver lining. It's still like sort of shocking and depressing when you think about the fact that those issues that started then, which we've opposed for so long, have not been resolved, and that those of us who have really kind of tried to stand up for ourselves in all of this and our interests and what we believe are having it kind of used against us.
Well, amen to that. After September 11th, I joined the Navy, and so when we invaded Iraq, I was watching it happen in the context of me learning Arabic and I was watching it on Al Jazeera, and so it was quite I was quite traumatized by that experience myself.
Yeah. I mean, it was really like weird to just be in college and walk into like a common space and see Fox News on the television, you know, and them just, you know, just totally just beating the war drum. And then, you know, the next day you would come in and it'd be CNN, and they'd just have another, you know, embedded journalist who's not criticizing anything and is just sort of basically part of the patriotic rally. And it was all just sort of surreal because just like 2 or 3 years earlier, we had all these big ideas and we were, as a progressive movement, you know, kind of rallying at the gates, you know, and it all kind of just turned into, it just sort of, you know, slipped out of our hands, I guess, became really difficult to maintain, I guess, a sort of rational compass in all of this.
So, what is your understanding of how the Nazi Party gained power and what lessons are there for us in that history?
I think it's a complicated question. Off the top of my head, you have to put the rise of the Nazis in a broader history of Germany as only uniting in a national sense, you know, in whatever, 1871 or something like that, with Bismarck and the Kaiser. The imperial ambitions of Germany, you know, sort of arose in the 1880s, and even Bismarck thought it was a little bit too heavy, which is wild because Bismarck was a pretty heavy dude. Hitler's Nazi movement couldn't have been possible without the empire and its aspirations and its legacy. One of the big things about the Nazi Party was its sort of geopolitical aspirations. And those don't exist without, you know, the geographer Friedrich Ratzel going into the Franco-Prussian War and coming back an anti-Semite and a sort of chauvinistic conservative. Before that, he was basically a liberal. So yeah, I think that, you know, historically you have to sort of recognize Nazism as an extension of the imperial history of Germany. And then in a much more sort of specific way, you know, you kind of need to dismantle the problems with Weimar Germany, not just constitutionally and juridically, but also as a rupture in the German imperial imaginary. It was much harder, you know, while the Bavarian Soviet was being established, or, you know, the Red Army of the Ruhr rose up. It was much easier for, you know, your average German, I think, to imagine a return to German chauvinism and imperialism than it was to imagine, you know, a kind of like a Bolshevik Germany, which is what a lot of the far left in Germany wanted. In that kind of meta narrative, you know, you have also the factions fighting against each other on the German left between the Social Democrats and the communists, as the communists militated against the state in order to effectively bring about a communist revolution, as opposed to leaning on the social democratic relationship with the conservative factions in order to maintain the hegemony of a republican system. The SPD's, you know, the Social Democrats' response to the communists was heavy-handed and brutal, and the communists always hated them for it, and even joined with the Nazis on more than one occasion in order to undermine the social democratic hegemony and to sort of upend the Republican system in which the center right gained power following or during the Great Depression. And that's, I think, maybe the final kind of turn of it, the social conditions that came about as a result of the Great Depression, wherein homelessness, joblessness increased, and the Nazis mobilized to provide services for the poor and angsty in Weimar, who looked at the Social Democrats as one of the reasons for the huge instability of the time, and who, you know, despised the communists as a sort of like foreign influence or what have you, and were drawn into the Nazi Party's anti-Semitic hatred. So I think that that's really what catapulted the Nazis into establishing themselves as a political force, along with their quite advanced electoral strategy, which, of course, I think was spurred on perhaps by massive doses of crystal meth. And of course, the center right and right wing nationalists were complicit the whole time, whether they were, you know, making deals with Hitler to beat down the left, or whether they were making deals with Hitler to undermine their opponents. The Nazis were quite good at manipulating the stupid opportunism of the right wing in Weimar Germany. So I think all of those things contributed to the rise of the Nazis, but it's still one of those historical abnormalities, I suppose, where you have this incredibly insane organization that's, you know, calling on these kinds of crazy occult sort of themes with the swastika and all of this kind of insanity. You know, it's one of those things where your kind of like worst nightmare just manifests, and it's hard to imagine how much people went through during that time period.
So what do you see are parallels between that whole development and what we're going through right now?
Well, just going back to the social conditions of a depression, I think that is significant to really think about. I don't think that there's quite the same conditions at this point, but it is easy to see how fascists and white nationalists have been manipulating within the Republican Party in order to gain hegemony, which is quite scary. You know, you have people like Stephen Miller who are trying to extend the suspension of green card applications and things like that indefinitely, I'm sure. You know, the hardcore street fascists or what have you, even the sort of like Richard Spencer types are more disenfranchised with Trump than they have been in the past. I think recently Richard Spencer said something like he regrets supporting Trump even. And then you have weird Matthew Heimbach pretending to join the left. So the fascists, at least on surface, appear to be in disarray. It really does seem like that whole arc that myself and Shane Burley and a lot of other people were predicting, where the Matthew Lyons being one of them, where they would, after Charlottesville, the public-facing alt-right would effectively dissolve into these kind of decentralized, disorganized terrorist units. That did, in fact, appear to happen, and those units seem to have been completely dismantled by the FBI and by anti-fascist exposure. So it doesn't look like, you know, 1931 or whatever in Germany, but, you know, it might look like 1939 in the US if we had a different president. Of course, I mean, like, the fact that Trump is in power and telling people to inject, you know, disinfectant or put sun shine wherever, is, you know, is an anomaly in itself. You know, I don't know if we've ever had a president who is this kooky. And we've certainly had presidents who have been as far right. So, yeah, I mean, it just seems like a different historical moment that I think we're going to actually pull ourselves out of. I'm not despairing when I look to the future. I think that things, you know, they can always get worse, but I'm not pessimistic. I'm not optimistic. I don't think that we're going to like just sort of like all of a sudden propel ourselves into like, you know, full luxury space communism or whatever. But I think that things will get better. And I think that our movement will return and will be better than ever. So, you know, I could always be wrong.
You're probably familiar with Robert Paxton. He writes about phases of fascist movement, moving from a grassroots movement to entry into official power to consolidating that power. It's clear that Trump is trying to dismantle the Department of Justice to gain some purchase there. But how far do you see that development going?
So just to rephrase the question to make sure I understand it, like the attempts of Nazis and fascists to root into power, to use Paxton's term, is in keeping with sort of like stage two or three of, you know, what he describes as a fascist incrementalism. Like, how's that working? I like that you asked about Europe too, because it's important to look at a sort of multi-scalar approach to analyzing political life in terms of complex systems. Fascism isn't a kind of discrete historical anomaly, I suppose. It's more of a part of a continuous ideological development that exists within the history of Western civilization. You have to look at it in a broad analytical framework, not to sort of transplant and write fascism back into history, but to understand the historical scope of how it developed and what it means. And not to delimit it to Western civilization, but to understand it as a kind of syncretic sacralization of politics that incorporates traditionalism with futurism and so on and so forth. When we look at their operations transnationally, you know, we have to understand that they're forming these international networks, and they have hubs, and they have nodes, and they have financial connections, material connections, training, and all of those kinds of things. Their most successful efforts in Europe have been indisputably the success of Brexit, the rise of Lega in Italy, and the FPO in Austria. Those were all supported by their friends in Russia. Brexit has just become a complete catastrophe, and nobody really supports it anymore. They just see it as a reality. Lega was brought down by corruption scandals involving, you know, Russian fascists and oligarchs. The FPO was brought down by someone posing as a representative of a Russian oligarch trying to do some corruption. So it's funny how they rise and fall, right? Like, they've had tremendous success electorally, but then, you know, just as suddenly they came crashing down, and now in electoral terms, it's almost as though they have to try to reinvent the wheel because, you know, they've been so thoroughly embarrassed. I think now in Germany, I think it was Thuringia, that's where the panic button started to get hit real hard. The center-right party, the Christian Democrats, their representative in the area sort of made a side deal with the far right AfD, and not just the far right AfD, but the furthest right faction within the AfD, in order to make sure that the left party did not get elected. When news of that agreement aired, it was a complete scandal. It was denounced by Merkel herself, and the Christian Democrats basically fell into disarray. So after that, that furthest right faction was effectively disbanded by the AfD, which was good news, but it was a sort of like they had accomplished what they wanted for them in a way, which was at least partially to break down the cordon sanitaire that separates the legitimate centrist parties from the wingnuts of the far right. And by wingnuts, I mean people connected to like QAnon conspiracy theories and all of that kind of stuff. So that's both shocking and frightening. But in terms of the building of some kind of multipolar coalition between Italy, Austria, Russia, and ineffectively sort of Eurosceptic hegemonic bloc within the EU, that's kind of fallen through a trapdoor in almost comical style. And it appears with that failure, Trump seems more marginalized from Europe, which is bad news for his reelection. Obviously, he wants as much international support as he can get. So that's why I'm not pessimistic when I look out and look to the future. Once we get the current trauma sort of controlled, I think that there's a strong likelihood Trump gets voted out, and in a strong repudiation of his entire legacy, many of his agenda points are reversed, and a different course is set with people who actually, for example, believe that climate change is anthropogenically forced and needs to be addressed as soon as possible.
In your personal experience, is the Spanish Civil War a big deal in radical circles? And do you have a favorite story from the Spanish Civil War? And just to give a little context, I was nervous about writing about it because people get emotional about this stuff, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, the Spanish Civil War is something that if you want to get into an argument, just throw that on the table. I mean,
right.
For that reason, I think it's actually... It depends on the circle that you're in. You know, I think a lot of people, you know, got through the 70s and 80s without thinking of the Spanish Civil War at all, not to mention the 90s and 2000s. I think that the Spanish Civil War just leapt back into the radical imagination with the YPG, YPJ, and the idea that a kind of free state in Rojava could actually produce a libertarian municipalist confederation that traversed gender and ethnic lines and actually, you know, broke down some of the biggest prejudices that people held about the region. And, of course, the just absolute evil of ISIS and this menace that they posed made the PYD, the YPG, YPJ, the Kurds appear that much more, you know, powerful and heroic. Before then, the Spanish Civil War was just something people got into arguments about in reading groups. I remember in New York City, in some of the circles that I was in, there was still support campaigns for veterans of the Spanish Civil War. Obviously, like Murray Bookchin was a big part of carrying forward the sort of the torch of memory of the conflict. The issue is that For anarchists, you get trapped in thinking of it as a state, fighting for an anarchist state, which is a contradiction in terms. The sort of left communist approach of like Orwell or someone like Langston Hughes, maybe people who fought in the International Brigades, represents a sort of a manifest class war, which sort of stokes people's ideals. But it's also just one of the sort of more grisly and depressing stories of the left. I think in terms of the sheer numbers of political opposition that he murdered, Franco outnumbered all his other fascist associates. It was absolutely bloody and terrifying. And Spain became a complete sort of cornerstone for the reassemblage of fascist international movement after the war, going all the way into the 1970s. So in those terms, I mean, really, you can't overestimate the importance of the Spanish Civil War, because Franco helped organize tyranny and authoritarianism throughout the world for decades after the conflict. Whereas if the Popular Front had won, which is always the historical question, you might not have even seen the meteoric rise of the Nazi expansion over Eastern Europe and then into France. One thinks that maybe if the Anglo American alliance had actually supported the Popular Front, history would have taken a very different turn. But instead, the turning of Spain represented just another domino in Hitler's war to conquer Europe and the world. So it's an important thing, which, makes it all the more embarrassing that, it's just an artifact for people to get into fights over and to stop talking to each other for.
Sure. True. And at the risk of causing controversy, what is your understanding of why the Spanish Republic was lost?
I mean, I mean, it boils down to a lot of different things. I think, first of all, on the ground in central Spain, southern Spain in particular, the Republicans were out-organized. The Falangists and the right-wingers used a lot of brutal methods to silence their political foes, and there wasn't a great respond to that. You have not just elected officials, but intellectuals, school teachers being just beaten down and driven out of different towns throughout the country before the war even started. And with the invasion, those really violent forces that had already assembled were poised to support Franco from behind the lines, whereas it took the Popular Front quite a while to actually mobilize its forces. I think the anarchists were the first ones to grab guns and form militias. You'd think that the state might have been a little bit better prepared than that. So, out-organized politically in a way. They also, did make a lot of mistakes. While anarchists and syndicalists were able to mobilize faster, they were also responsible for some really, really appalling excesses connected to their version of a revolution. You had a lot of church burnings, and while I recognize that the church in Spain at the time represented an absolutely oppressive force, I don't think you want to go around burning churches in a strongly Catholic place and think you're gonna sway the mood of the people, especially in those circumstances. You also have these political assassinations that were happening, like of Calvo Sotelo, who was a far-right Catholic. Sotelo didn't necessarily pose that much of a threat, at the time, and by assassinating him, those forces sent shockwaves through Spain that partially prompted Franco's invasion. So, you know, those are some serious mistakes. There needs to be better discipline than that. A big problem with that is that the lack of discipline was part of what contributed to the Anglo-American alliance basically dropping the ball. And I don't think that means that you have to take accountability away from, you know, the United States and from the UK for abandoning democracy at that time. But you can also say, you know, what was going on there contributed to those decisions. Once Franco gets to Madrid, after the siege of Madrid, the war basically becomes completely unwinnable. You have all the infighting between factions becoming increasingly ferocious as they're sort of cornered in Barcelona. Any, you know, book you read about the history of the Spanish Civil War, you'll find new parties to blame. Obviously, throughout the whole disaster, and part of the reason why they lost Madrid is the factional infighting that was already taking place, and the gradual sort of advance of Stalinist hegemony over the entire Popular Front, through which they were able to marginalize and subvert competing factions. The trade-off, of course, was trying to get as many materials, including oil and guns, like drawing water from a rock. So, you know, the whole thing perhaps was doomed from the beginning. I don't, you know, you can always spread blame around. There's enough to go around and so on. Maybe you can just blame history for being very cunning and terrible. But hey, you know, at least they tried.
Do you read Timothy Snyder at all?
I do, yeah. I like that book. Maybe, I don't remember which one it was, The Road to Unfreedom or something like that. I think that was the one that I read.
It's a good book, and I'm going to talk about several of his books later on in the podcast, but the one I'm thinking of right now is Black Earth, where he links Hitler's second volume of Mein Kampf, where he talks about Lebensraum, and he conceives of the natural world as being one where you have limited natural resources. And so one of the big thrusts of his political agenda was to create for Germany an American-style empire so that they could enjoy an American lifestyle. And that was why the centerpiece of his strategy was occupying the Ukraine as a colonial project for the Germans. But what I wanted to ask you about was the connection between Dugin, is it Alexander Dugin, I think?
Yeah.
Environmentalism. Yeah. And what is the appeal of fascism to environmentalists more broadly?
Yeah. So Dugin sort of got a start around various, like, occult and esoteric fascist organizations in the Soviet Union. They really loved to read fascist poetry and, like, sort of wax philosophic or aesthetic about, you know, Heidegger or Giulio Vola, the fascist mystic and ultra-violent influence on the far-right terrorist movement of the 1970s. Those kind of circles were also, you know, engaged with some kinds of, like, Volkish sort of environment or ecologically oriented ideas. And when Dugin started the National Bolshevik Party with Edward Limonov in the 19, probably like 1990 something, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, they basically adopted a lot of those kinds of like radical environmental movement strategies and tactics of direct action, like kind of cribbing from Greenpeace by doing those kinds of like disruptive actions and stuff like that, but for fascism. So there's kind of like a two-tier like theory and practice cribbing from the ecology movement that kind of goes further back into the history of fascist ideology. I mean, in the 1930s, there were lots of kind of like organic farming groups and animal rights groups and people who kind of tried to fuse geopolitics with ecological ideas in order to criticize modern civilization and promote some kind of like Volkish alternative, with like ethnostates being organized hierarchically in accordance with sort of traditional patriarchal norms and mores. Evola was kind of part of that world, obviously one of the biggest influences for Dugin. Dugin sort of has promoted different groups, like he was part of like a network with Troy Southgate, who's a so-called national anarchist fascist who has promoted this idea of entryism into the environmental movement and animal rights movement, whereby fascists sort of pretend to be autonomists or act in kind of nationalist autonomist form and either derail them or turn them into fascist organizations, use them as vectors, kind of like a virus, or rather hosts. Dugin has more recently proposed expanding this kind of method of entryism and like courting green theorists. That's what he calls them, like green theorists. People like John Zerzan, who's an anti-civilization, you know, radical green thinker, trying to sort of draw the green movement into a more ethnocentric and traditionalist zone of ideological influence. And, you know, there's been some efforts, you know, to influence the green movement. I think RT's presence in Standing Rock was one thing that people have pointed out as like, this is interesting. But yeah, also through the Internet Research Agency and their general strategy of trying to pit different, you know, marginal or non-hegemonic groups against one another in order to destabilize the center in general. So I don't know. There's a lot of complexity there. I know I'm kind of simplifying on this interview, but yeah.
In March of 2018, you wrote an article for the Southern Poverty Law Center about multipolar spin.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us what that article was about? What is multipolar spin and what occurred after that article was published?
Yeah, sure. I mean, just like we've been talking about with regards to disinformation and the networks that, you know, disseminate it, my article is basically an attempt to expose how right-wing groups connected and affiliated with Dugin are trying to draw the left into an alliance that would oppose neoliberal hegemony. And my argument there is that, you know, opposition to neoliberal hegemony is fine, normal stuff. But going into an alliance with fascists is bad for a number of reasons. It's just stupid. It's a bad strategy. And I pointed out, several organizations, especially organizations that are favorable to Assad and Putin, contain fascists and are involved in networks in which fascists are, driving principles. Yeah, so it's not a particularly controversial premise, but it became very controversial because of the extent to which these networks have normalized themselves and their skill at inverting everything that people say in order to try to shirk accountability. So my piece was like turned inside out, completely misrepresented, attacked, and maligned in these circles that I was pointing to. And it was really interesting because, the people who were attacking the piece were literally doing exactly what I had pointed out, which is that there's, this sort of confluence of left and right towards a specific geopolitical agenda that's understood as multipolarism, trying to unite left-wing, like authoritarian left-wingers, with the far right in order to reproduce an authoritarian world system. The outcry against the article was just sort of like a reification of the actual system that I showed. The website backed down and retracted the article and issued an apology that was saying that they didn't retract the piece because it was factually wrong. They did it because of the outcry and the extent to which the perception of the piece had moved from its original intent to something that it didn't mean, which, really just kind of like threw me for a complete loop. Like, and by retracting the article, they showed how strong these networks are now in the American left, and they showed, what they're capable of, but they also led to the piece getting a lot more attention. The contents of the article have been reproduced in one shape or another across multiple websites, and the facts that I covered have been reiterated in two or three peer-reviewed, well-regarded academic publications now, at this point. So, as well as different sort of public media, I don't know what to say. I didn't get anything really wrong. There's one thing where like Tim Pool denies that he went to this event where his name appears on the list of scheduled speakers. But again, that's one thing where you can just sort of add a caveat at the very end, like an editor's note, just saying like Tim Pool denies that he was there. So I support, everything that I wrote down, and I've moved on.
To me, the episode just seemed was really sad and discouraging because it showed an unwillingness to come to terms with these very serious liabilities in our movement.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just there's been also pretty overwhelming hypocrisy from a lot of people who have ritually gotten things totally wrong in their reporting, and never retracted a single word of it. Like I've been completely and utterly disproved and have never gone back or apologized. So, just the unscrupulous nature of, I guess, the business and the people really kind of takes you aback. But, again, it's just something that you have to live with because this is the world, I guess, that we've created. And we have to also just take responsibility for ourselves and try to live our best lives, I feel very strongly, actually, that the only thing that we have at the end of the day is our integrity. But as long as we have that, we can move forward and, you know, be proud of ourselves and not let the sort of like trolls and vipers of the world bring us down. And we can fight against them, and sometimes we win, sometimes we lose.
So it's a little over a month now that we've been social distancing, and we've started to see far-right groups publicly rallying to reopen the economy. I guess I've got written down here, what are they thinking? But what does Alex Jones gain from these public displays? But what I'm really interested to know is, what exactly do they hope to gain by doing these things?
I think a lot of it is just knee-jerk. You know, a lot of the way that they operate is kind of like seat of the pants, just like reaction, you know? And so in this case, you know, you have a lot of liberals saying, you know, we need to be conservative, and you have a lot of conservatives jumping out of their skin and screaming, you know, like Donald Trump did, like liberate Michigan or whatever. So it's another one of these kinds of crazy historical eddies where all the different kind of political traditions are upended, and we have to sort of reorient ourselves in a very, you know, rapidly changing environment, which, you know, requires a lot of emotional resilience and intellectual adaptivity. But it's also just kind of like using common sense, you know. It's like, let's not, you know, let a pandemic, you know, last for a year or more. Industrial actors have kind of been pushing for people to get back to work. That might also be kind of a big issue. You know, you've got dark money kind of getting into these movements and helping to push them forward. So I think that, you know, it's not just a question of like knee-jerk seat of the pants, like we want to do whatever the anti-government, anti-liberal thing is. It's more complicated than that. Just like climate denial is more complicated than that. I think you do have these kinds of big money interests that are trying to get the economy restarted to protect their pocketbooks. And they're kind of hoping that the right-wing street movement will help push that forward. But it was really a bad gambit because they were exposed by, I think, by The Guardian. People know that dark money was involved. And and the protests everywhere just increased hostility against these kinds of forces, especially as, you know, people came out just like full on Nazis, you know, yeah, joining these protests. It's just like, how stupid do you have to be to actually buy into all this stuff? So I think it kind of backfired significantly.
Yeah, I don't know. This whole period has just been one day after day, more and more like WTF moments. But one of them recently was Jacobin writing this article that basically normalized what the protesters were representing. It just seemed very off key.
Yeah, they tend to, I think that they kind of started out with this kind of cheeky approach and like this really great aesthetic look that was kind of new and interesting. And they had these kind of provocative articles, like in favor of air conditioning units or something like that, which is like for so many people just like a no-brainer, but like also one of those things that like the fact that it's not a no-brainer on the left shows part of like why the left can get so marginalized sometimes.
Yeah.
So they started out kind of like, let's take, you know, liberalism seriously and let's not just be kind of reactive. At this point, I think the aesthetics have gone a little old, and I think that they've maybe fallen into a trap of unfortunately becoming contrarians for the sake of being contrarian. And I think, you know, they had a few pretty big mishaps, speaking of retracting articles, that were, you know, that, you know, you give them a lot of leeway, but at this point, it's kind of like, okay, the game is pretty much up. I mean, you know, one of their recent articles is also like a really, really kind of cringy obituary for Edward Limonov, who was Dugin's partner.
I wasn't going to mention it because I hadn't read it, so I don't really know how bad it was, but how bad was it?
It was bad. I mean, there's no need to write about the guy. I mean, if you... So, usually with fascists, the most I see is, like, Edward Limonov, rest in piss, or something like that, you know? Like, you're not going to have, like, some kind of, like, fawning, you know, recounting of his career. And it's just, it's also got complete falsehoods. It's like talking about how his followers were peaceful and stuff like that is absolutely absurd. He was recruiting fighters for Novorossiya. And he like himself claimed to have fought in like Transnistria. He participated in the siege of Sarajevo. You know, he actually tried to invade Kazakhstan, if I'm not mistaken, with a small detachment of forces. like, he was not at all, not at all, like a peaceful guy. I mean, I think he was actually one of these people whose slogan was "War is peace," because of how much he loved being in war. And at one point he said that, you know, Russia was being, you know, overcome by immigrants and that they could learn from the Serbian example, you know, just like openly calling for a genocide. And he's got very influential supporters who love him and are popular on the American left because of their sort of transgressive style, you know? So because of that, you know, there are these sort of cliques and groups that think it's fun, you know, fascism is fun. It's disgusting, it's disturbing, and there's no reason to romanticize it or even play into that romanticism. And I think that the obit was really playing into the romanticism of it. It got a lot of things just flat out wrong, and it was a pretty big shame to see it in such a high profile left journal that I myself have written for and actually had a pretty good experience writing for. But yeah, you're right. It's like this is the Trump era, and we're seeing a lot of the left just showing its ass. Verso is another good example.
I'm sure if you mentioned an example that I would recognize it or I would remember it, but I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Well, Verso published Max Blumenthal's book, which itself has a number of falsehoods that were reported in a book review in the Times, the London Times, which said that in publishing this book, Verso had blown a hole in its reputation, you know.
There's so much of this stuff, though. It's like for instance, Katie Halper the other day tweeting, maybe it was back in November, she was tweeting praise for Max Blumenthal, and you kind of wonder to yourself, how far down the rabbit hole is Katie Halper?
They're terrible. I mean, Katie Halper is a co-host with Matt Taibbi, who himself is a big Limonov fan, you know, and they've hosted on that podcast Max Blumenthal himself, as well as a number of other, you know, dirtbags.
Yeah.
Members of the dirtbag left, I should say.
Yeah. Among people you know in the radical community, what is the general attitude about the 2020 election?
Oh, it's mixed. I think most people are like, hold their nose and vote for Biden or whatever. I know in the Louisiana elections that David Duke ran for, the one that he lost, there was a slogan because the person he was running against was an obvious, obviously corrupt politician. But the slogan going around on bumper stickers was "Vote for the crook, it's important." So, I think at this point it's like you've got like this psychopathic white nationalist in office who has like taken the country completely off its rails and thrown everything into basically like a nationalist revolutionary, situation. Or you could vote for just kind of like a milquetoast centrist Democrat, And I think that, there's a validity in the opinion that as the party has moved further left, Biden has basically gravitated with it in its center. And so I think most of the left just thinks, get Trump out of office and then we can sort of talk about things. But there are a lot of kind of these more would-be radical elements in the left that are like, we'll never vote for Biden, and even, acting as though Biden and Trump are just the same, and that there's no difference between them, which is the same argument that was used with Clinton and was, transparently false then as well. There's a non-electoral left that never votes and doesn't really care. And there are some that are actively saying, don't vote for Biden. Some that are saying, vote for Jesse the Body Ventura, who is like a total conspiracy theorist, which is again just like, here comes the Green Party doing its thing. I don't think that there are as many people openly saying that Trump is a better candidate now. In 2015 and 2016 especially, you had people on the left involved with The Nation and so on, Matt Taibbi, the usual suspects, effectively saying Trump was the peace candidate, the candidate of détente, and Hillary Clinton was the hawk candidate, like with Slavoj Žižek saying, he would vote for Trump because it would bring about a great awakening or something like that. You actually had this pretty surprising turn at that time of left wingers who were pitching Trump as a better foreign policy guy. And I don't think you have that as much now because of his record, which is just deplorable. It's kind of impossible to take those stances. It'll be interesting to see if people actually take Jesse Ventura seriously at all on the left, as opposed to just ha ha, lol, he's better than Biden. But I don't expect that to happen.
Well, look, it's been great talking with you. That's all the questions. I want to thank you for agreeing to this interview. I think your work is really important.
Ah, thank you. I appreciate it.
An almanac tells us what the climate is, when to plant, and when to reap. In this Democratic Socialist Almanac, I'm going to review the history of the socialist tradition in the light of the latest scholarship. I'll be talking about the good, the bad, and every one of us living in between. Once we've sorted out how we got here, we'll survey the paths now open to us and begin a discussion of where we want to go. Follow us on Facebook, support us on Patreon, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from.